Before we go any farther with anything, I want to do one thing that I always sort of cringe about doing because it's so slick. It's like Madison Avenue, you know, and you think, ah, it comes straight out of emergence theology, though, itself. And they will say, and it has to do with the hyphenateds and some of the distinction, a big distinction, as a matter of fact, between them and pure emergence, is that they will say, if you are going to be a Methodist or a Presbyterian or a Baptist or whatever, if you're going to join a group of Baptists, let's say, you're going to have to believe something. And you're also going to have to behave. You're going to have to, at least in public, agree to behave in a certain way. As are just givens. You cannot join until you make some sort of statement. But that comes straight out of the Reformation. I meant it. The creeds, and not the creeds, but the catechisms are a product of the Reformation. Comes straight out of it. And so you're going to have to believe something and sign off on it publicly. You're going to have to agree to a form of behavior. And at that point, you can belong. And that's the traditional way in emergence. It's the other way around. You belong simply because you show up in this place. Be this place a bar, a pub, a coffee house, it doesn't matter. You belong simply because you keep showing up. And because we're all a little simian, eventually you will begin to ape us. That is, you will begin to behave as we behave. And at some point, you'll wake up one day and discover you believe something. Because it will be incarnated belief. And that's the difference. And where the separation happens between pure emergence, which I could now make the whole circle, between that and hyphenated, is very often on that very basis right there, is that if you, in order to join that church, have to make a statement of belief, or that group, then it's at most hyphenated. It's not pure emergence. Pure emergence would never ask you to make a belief statement in order to come and be part of it. So that's a distinction that we need to make between the two. Now, I want to go back to the Queen of England before we go any farther, before we go to the next state. I want to know how many of you would help God save the Queen and why? Who wants to go first? My Canadians. Okay. They may come from a prejudicial point of view.
I think we just think that it would be unlikely that they'll get rid of the monarchy.
Oh, the likelihood is not up for grabs. Of course they're not going to. But you're to postulate that it's a legitimate question.
We think the wild card in England right now is with the influx of immigration.
The influx of
immigration from all the Commonwealth countries. And so that's going to change the balance. Traditional British people, I think, still have a deep affection for the monarchy. The Queen is dearly loved. Now, once she dies, that could throw it wide open because Prince Charles is not dearly loved, and he's, I think, done real damage to the family and to the monarchy. The speculation is whether the Queen is trying to live long enough to name her successor and bypass and go to Diana's sons, which I think are loved by the populace.
Okay.
But that's not easy to do either.
But if none of the above happened, if she were to die today, and next week they said you can vote whether to keep the monarchy or not, how would you vote?
Would us, or how would they vote?
How would you vote if you were a British citizen?
Look at my age, I would say keep it.
Yeah.
You'd say keep it?
We would both say keep the monarchy.
Well, why?
Well, I guess it's part of the, you know, maybe it's our reaction to our lost cousins called the Americans. You know, the one thing you don't get to do in a monarchy is vote for the monarchy.
Ah, so you'd change the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. All right, in order to keep it. Yeah. And you would keep it out of affection?
And also pragmatism.
Pragmatism, why?
Because the monarchy in the British system tempers its so-called parliamentary system. If you don't have a strong monarch, even though the monarch doesn't have real political power, she does have tremendous influential power, and it tempers what can become a dictatorship by the prime minister. in a majority parliamentary government.
And so you would keep it as an influence. Mm-hmm. Affection and an influence.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else want to keep the monarchy?
I would keep it, and I think a lot of my undergraduate students would also want to keep it because it's part of, it's the story, and the story tells us who we are.
Yeah, I was going to say keep it because it's a very British identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Identity, narrative, affection, influence. Anybody else want to keep it?
Well, I considered not the British monarchy, but I'm third generation American-Norwegian, so I was thinking of the Norwegian.
Okay.
And I would definitely keep that. That's my history. That's my grandmother. And like Bob said, that's my story. That's part of my story.
All right.
Yeah, I'd keep it too, but I'd sell the art and feed the poor.
All right. Would you seriously, or are you being?
No, funny? I'm serious.
Okay.
I'm serious.
Get All right.
He has no All idea right. what it means.
Anybody else going to keep it?
I'd keep it because. It's my story, so that's why we keep it. But I would want to move it to be different from the past. And so I probably would want to re-image some of the monarchy. And I like the idea of selling off some of the assets, mm-hmm. you know, and giving it to help the people of my country.
So you would take the House of Windsor's bank account down considerably?
I would take it down by probably third, half. I mean, it'd be...
Even though it really isn't British, it's owned.
No, it's owned by the family.
Yeah,
it's
but you would private the terms.
Yeah, but I would say this is what I believe would be the best thing for our country.
Okay. Anybody want to get rid of it? Okay.
Yeah, it's an anachronism. It serves no useful purpose in governing the nation. You know, other than its. Tradition, but it serves no useful purpose. Let's get on with the future.
Can it not be part of the story?
Okay.
It's still no longer there.
Yeah.
Can it still be part of the story?
That's a very good question. Very good
make
question.
Make all of those...
You understand, of course, that what we're getting rid of is not the Queen of England. What we're getting rid of it here is the established church. You understand what we're doing.
But that's the reason to get rid of it, is because the established church is so messed up, and you keep this shell of a nothing that it hinders.
And so how do you deal with the affection and the narrative and to some extent?
You tell the stories.
I'm with you.
It will go away. It won't be as strong.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like my daddy who lived through Prohibition said, yeah, everybody drank during Prohibition, but they drank less. I mean, there was not as much drinking around during Prohibition.
And it was riskier.
And it was riskier, and there wasn't as much.
Yeah.
And and that's... I don't know what that trade-off is.
Yeah.
But you could tell the story still.
Yes.
Well, is it fair to say that the monarchies, all of them, are a shadow of their former self?
Absolutely.
This conversation under Henry would have been an act of treason, and you would have washed your hands.
Oh, I wouldn't have made it to 11 o'clock.
No.
Yeah. It would have been instant.
They are, in some sense, a shell.
Is the church.
Well, that's an interesting thing.
Is your son right? That's basically what we're saying.
Yeah.
Every time you ask this question, and there is a second question that I suppose I should ask now and let you catch this for a minute, but every time you ask this question of a group, you can pretty much tell where they are in relation to the established church, because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that we're really not concerned with the King of England or the Queen of England, that what we're really talking about is a long-standing established form of hierarchy. And would you keep it? The second and concomitant question is, what is the use of the institution? Not necessarily the monarchy now, but what is the use of the institution? What is the purpose of an institution? And does institutionalized church fulfill it now? Just think about it for a minute before we go too far in this.
Well, I find it difficult to figure out how you gauge the good that every one of our established institutions is doing. against the places we fail. How do you get an accurate tally of is the bad, is the loose, is the shell? Is that balancing so heavily that we discard the good? I don't know how you weigh that. And at this point in history, historically speaking, mm-hmm. 2009, how you adequately weigh where the established church is in terms of you cannot discount that we are all called and are serving a church that is purported to do good. That is, you know. And so how do you weigh that? And when do you come, when is the decision a clear, you know, we're no longer relevant? I don't find a clear footing there.
Yeah. I'm big on form follows function. I have no use for a hierarchy that provides no function. The emergent church, may be great for sharing the gospel, making disciples on a local level. The thing that the institutional church still provides, and so I wouldn't do away with it, is it gives you a national or global voice. The Pope has presence. He can get a message across.
Great
your
clothes.
Local emergent church.
Great clothes.
Great clothes.
How about the shoes?
Yeah.
The shoes, the hats, the coolest part.
But bingo on that. That's one of the answers. That's emergence has now. I think we need to say at this point. I'm going to give it back to you in just a minute. But may I react? See, take a record. I'm not going to talk this afternoon. Yeah, Bill doesn't believe it. But what you just said is, I think, very significant. One of the things we need to say about emergence Christianity is, and that's the reason I wanted to start with the questions, is we now need to take it out of this country for a minute anyway, and be aware that this is an international thing that's happening. As I said, in the English-speaking colonies, former colonies of the Crown, it's called Fresh Expressions, by and large. In Africa, it's Amhara. I don't remember its name in Germany, if I ever knew it. But this is a sensibility or a change in the church that is purely international. And one of the difficulties is you can hop the pond back and forth. McLaurin goes to Africa all the time, or he goes to Australia all the time, and they back and forth. I'm going to Ireland in March. The only reason I remember that is I'm going to be there for St. Patrick's Day. Whoever thought I'd be in Ireland? Doing Fresh Expressions with Pete Rollins, who is icon, and some other Irish folk. So there's a lot of hopping in a pond, but the ability to do what you just said, that, and it's close to what you were saying about influence. It's the ability to deliver also goods. Just plain old goods, and the ability to distribute globally. You can talk about glocal all you want to. And glocal is an emergence Christianity's one of its buzzwords is glocal, which is to say that there is no local anymore. Everything is global. But the ability, there's X number of stuff you can transfer on the web. And short of some kind of really wonderful miracle, you can't transport goods. And you can't sustain a permanent influence. What you can do is the flash crowds, or the wild crowds, or the scary mass. There are various terms for it. In which you can text people and say, everybody come quick to Penn Station right now, or be there at 11:20, we're going to have a demonstration, and they'll be there. The Tea Parties about 3 weeks ago, the TEA parties, were put together that way. That was a flash crowd. But they go away because they're built on tech. One of the reasons for the institution is exactly what you just put your finger on. Another reason for the institution... We're defending the church here, people.
It gives some discipline.
They pay our
salaries. And of course, we don't want any discipline. But you kind of need some discipline. And if you just, maybe all the discipline they want is some. I mean, the whole idea of monasteries and stuff is obedience and to a discipline. But you need a discipline. And the problem is with revolutions come about when they think that the disciplining authority is not disciplining correctly anymore.
Yeah.
But I think you need a discipline thing, because I don't think I think that the proper discipline was not on either camps.
Okay.
And I think you need an organization.
You need an overseer.
An overseer?
No, the community, but not an overseer.
Exactly. Yeah. Come on, that's the emergence answer. You need a community, and not necessarily an overseer. The other thing you open the door to, Ted,
but is little communities are much likely to go off in wrong directions than larger communities.
Yes.
And that's what I'm saying.
Him?
You need a large community.
He's absolutely right. Now,
the Orthodox people, Orthodox Church is very good about a big, and the way they arrive at things.
That's
in
right.
A large
right.
community.
May I counter? Because what I hope to do is expose by conversation here what an emergence thing is really about. They call themselves Wiki Church. After Wikipedia, or after the wiki that Wikipedia gets its name for, whatever you want to call it, which is to say that you're absolutely right. A small group can go way off center. There is no question that you take 6 or 8 people or you take 300 people, and they can become idiosyncratic in a heartbeat. And the most famous example of that within emergence is an early emergence called the 9 o'clock service. And you may want to Google the 9 o'clock service. It happened in England. And Matthew Fox, if that right. name means anything right. to some of you, and it probably will, got involved in that. Mm-hmm. And it became, it devolved from an emergence or fresh expression thing straight into a cult, and from a cult into sexual aberrations that, you know, you would die to be able to see on film if not participate in. You know, I mean, if you're given to pornography, I mean, it really got ugly. And it changed Father Fox's whole ministry, that exposure. So it can become very idiosyncratic. There is no question. But one of the characteristics of emergence Christianity, and that's what we're really talking about now, what does this thing look like? One of the characteristics of it is that neo-monasticism, pseudo-monasticism, or whatever you want to call it, they usually refer to it as neo-monasticism. Some of them call it radical monasticism, in which they say that every emergence, little community or big community, is on a spectrum somewhere between vowed just to see after each other in terms of prayer and keeping up with each other, all the way over to common purse, common table, and some of them even to obedience and constancy. That is to say that, and Thomas Sine, S-I-N-E, Dr. Thomas Sine, who is the authority on the monastic movement within emergence, says that a quarter of emergence Christians are in some form of vowed monastic relationship. That those little communities that we see as house churches or that we see as pub theology or whatever are somewhere on a spectrum. They have pledged to each other some kind of support on that spectrum. More and more of them are now doing the common person, common table. They're actually the poster child for this is The Simple Way in Philadelphia with Shane Claiborne, if that means anything to you, or Rutba House in North Carolina with Jonathan Wilson Hargrove and his wife lead that one. There are many others. There are thousands of them around. And they, St. Elizabeth's in Cincinnati is a beautiful example. They're therefore the exact, it's the emergence answer to what you just raised, because you're absolutely right. You need some rules. But their answer is that the community makes the rules. And if this little community in this larger cohort, if in the cohort of Jacksonville, there is pub theology down at Kudzu's, and they are meeting and they are beginning to do more than pub theology. They are actually having services. They are having the mass. They are in a space that they probably rented or borrowed or somewhere. And they're beginning to be a church. And if they get too far out, the cohort is going to realize it and correct them. In the same way that if an entry in a wiki, Wikipedia gets too far out, somebody jumps in. Now, my answer to that, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see this one, is that there's somebody editing Wikipedia exactly. who tags it and says, ooh, this is way off, you know, or be careful here, this has not been vetted. That part of the puzzle isn't there in emergence just yet. But they would counter that the monasticism is exactly part of what you're talking about, and that it's enormously important, and it's an important thing to them. I said yesterday that and I've said it 1,000 times, you've heard it 1,000 times before, that there are 5 tributaries to the river, that is Christianity and Roman Catholicism and Pentecostalism, Protestantism, and then Anglicanism. And nobody blanched when I said it. And one of the reasons that Anglicanism is not fully Protestant, is not part of the other traditions, is what we fondly refer to as Hooker's Damn Stool. And Hooker's three-legged stool, as you know, because you're Anglican, in which we never believe sola scriptura. Sola scriptura was never taken as a fundamental. We assumed that scripture was one of the legs of that stool, and that the other was second one was tradition, and then reason was the third, and that you arrived at what was your authority by putting those three together. And I was talking a couple of months ago. To an emergent pastor, a lady pastor, who said, ultimately, when we answer the authority question, and that's what we're getting at right here, of course, when we answer the authority question, and we have to answer it, she said, there's no question that we've got to come up with something that is analogous to sola scriptura and what it was for Luther. When we answer that question, it's going to be Hooker's stool. And she said, one of the legs is going to be scripture. We all know that. We're not too sure what the other two are going to be. But I would lay my money that one of the legs is going to be community. And I said, you're probably right. I can believe that that's the second leg. And she said, I'm really not sure what the third one's going to be. Whether it's going to be Trinity or whether it's going to be Holy Spirit or what. We're not sure. And then she said to me this thing, and she said, but you know, you Anglicans have lived for 500 years with that stool, which she also referred to as Hooker's damn stool, and you never asked yourselves what was sitting on top of the three legs. Hmm. And I thought, she's absolutely right. Never thought about it. Never thought about it. What a concept. I love emergence, you know? And she laughed because I was flummoxed. You know, I went, oh, you're right, you know? And she thought it was funny, and then she said, and what we're going to do before we're over, I think, is say what's going to be on the stool.
The church.
Well, we don't know. She didn't know. But, you know, it was an interesting approach. And it really did. It stopped me dead. She's absolutely right. Who else would keep the institution?
Well, I think it's inevitable.
Or what's the use of it? What is the use of the institution, really?
The
same. It'll get the same answer.
I mean, I think institution is inevitable, even if we tore it all down. Let's face it. What names are we mentioning? We're mentioning Paget. We're mentioning Jones.
McLaurin.
Kimball,
what are they?
McLaren. You know, on the other
Feller.
End, we have Driscoll and McManus. So there isn't. There are popes already. Bishops already, and
that's right.
There is a hierarchy. But it's a young hierarchy. I visited an emergent church not long ago, and they were stumbling around during announcements because they were afraid to use the N-word, which was nursery. They were uncomfortable saying, well, I guess we need to do something with the kids, and maybe we need to form like a... I'm just thinking, say it. I was part of the Jesus movement. We were exactly where you were 20 years ago.
Exactly.
So I think it is inevitable.
It is. This will institutionalize.
Sure.
It will absolutely
institutionalize.
It is the nature of the human animal to institutionalize, and it's going to happen, whether they want it to happen or not. And I think you're quite right about the fact. We now know where most of the big leaders are. The thing I want to respond to in what you just said, however, is the nursery part. Simply because emergence Christianity is going to happen. There's nothing we can do to stop it. It's there. But we do have to be aware of it's got some weak spots, and one of them is the nursery. Because they're great with little kids, and they're great with 15-year-olds and above. But those middle school kids, they are clueless about what to do with. And I was talking to 3 or 4 weeks ago a young couple, a middle-aged couple, and he was an emergence pastor, and she was totally supportive of that ministry. And she came up and said, we just have to ask somebody, and you may not be able to answer the question, but she said, I have a third grader and a fifth grader. And she said, I love what your daddy does. I love going to service in our church. I love every part of our community. But they're not doing anything for my third grader and my fifth grader. She said they were grand through the first 6 years of each child's life. And she said, but now there's nobody forming them. There's nothing there. And we're trying to decide as a couple whether I drop back to being a Presbyterian until they get to be 15 or 16 and can go back to church with their daddy.
There's no scripture teaching?
They're teaching, but not particular to... And she went on to say, she said, there's a time...
That was trying to teach.
Well, she said there's a time in a child's life when you just say, I know you don't like to multiply, but just do it. Learn 2 times 2 is 4, 2 times 4 is 8, 2 times 8 is 16, not because it thrills you, but because you're going to need to know that at some point. And she said, we have in the emergence movement no program for saying, this is Melchizedek, this is Abram until his name changes, this is Abraham who was Abram. He changes here for this reason. You don't have to understand it. You don't have to do exegesis on it. You just need to know that that's the thrust of the truth. This is, yeah, you know, just learn, What?
It's a beautiful story whether it happened or not.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story whether it happened or not. That's right, yeah. It's a beautiful story. And you don't have to decide whether it happened. You just have to know what the story is. You know, you have to know what the books of the Bible are in some kind of order. Why? Because it's wonderful to know and exciting? No. Because you're in third or fourth or fifth or sixth grade, and you're supposed to learn this in order to go forth, and it's one of the places the institution can do it. And emergents are not only allergic to real estate; they're definitely allergic to programs for very good reason. They've been scarred by them, and this looks like a program, smells like a program, walks like one, and talks like one. Let's go do it. And so they've got this vacuum. All right, why else? What else does the institution do that makes it worth keeping? Because what we're really building, I think, is the case for the hyphenateds in many ways.
What happens when money shows up?
When money shows up, if they're way over here on the monastic part of the deeply monastic end of the spectrum, some of those, like Rutte House, for instance, where all of the adults are working, they live on 15% of their income and the other 85% is given to their neighborhoods. One of the things about emergence, one of the great things about emergence is not only are they deeply communal, but they truly believe that you should live and worship at the same place, and that larger area is your community, and it's yours to keep it up, to help, and everybody is welcome at the table. Whoever shows up for supper is there to eat. And so the money is deployed this way, which gets back to the problem of not being able to do a lot of international missions.
Who decides which of the very worthy needs is addressed? And that brings me to the hierarchical.
All right. Okay. Mission. This brings us to another thing. Because there is a quarter of it is social justice in its orientation. Emergents will talk very seriously about acts of inhumane kindness, which is, of course, an oxymoron, by which they mean that the institutional church has managed to make giving and acts of social justice an intellectual activity, or one that makes you feel better, or one that somehow justifies the institution. And so what you get is a relieving of poverty, or you get legislation that makes things better, or you get all of those things, but there's no involvement beyond the head. And so what you have is acts of kindness that are inhumane, that are not incarnate, that are not part of your spiritual growth, not born of your love. And they will argue that if it's done without love, then it's just done in the name of some sort of intellectual exercise. And that the institution immediately intellectualizes acts of mercy and compassion. And the doctrine is that in order to love, you have to forgive. And in order to forgive, the first thing you have to do is to forgive the otherness of the other, which I love. I mean, this is one place they persuade me. You have to forgive the otherness of the other. And the only love that doesn't involve forgiving the otherness of the other is erotic love that usually goes away within 6 months and settles down into a controlled combat from there on called marriage. But it's learning to forgive your neighbor for being poor, to forgive the guy down the street for being a predator, to forgive, not to ignore the fact he's a predator or that he's poor for reasons in his own personality, but to forgive it in such a way that you can love him or her within his or her restrictions.
So kind of like the shack.
Well, the shack always comes up right about here. And there's a strong element of emergence in the shack.
Yeah.
They cringe and die, if one can generalize, over the representation of the Holy Spirit. The notion of a nymph flying around in the garden doesn't fly because they're deeply into. But yes, there's a lot of the shack.
Well, so you were saying to forgive them, and
and that's what it was all about.
Your body, that's right. I forgive.
And that's why that's puppy's self. But you're absolutely right. How do you, within the institution, deploy goods and do acts of mercy that don't become intellectualized? How do they become anything other than an arm of affecting the social and cultural context in which the institution exists, as opposed to actually shaping the spirituality or the Christianity or the devotion or the love of the individual giver? It's a place where the institution has failed to some extent. Yes, sir. You look like you're going to say. Oh, you're stretching. Okay.
But that is the one thing that I struggle a lot with the SBC is they the international missions wonderfully through the
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the one thing I really think they've done right, but our churches do it all from the intellectual point unless they are involved in self-submissions, and we've lost that connection to those people and their ministries individually. It's just like, we can give the money that takes care of my mission work.
That's right. And the emergence would say, not only is that, you know, impersonal, it is absolutely damaging to the spiritual growth of the individual who puts the money into the plate and never says anything. But that lack of engagement is positively damaging.
I mean, and within my church itself, we're doing deliberate things like getting a couple of the missionaries that we're giving to and begin to partner with them personally. And so that we can keep a contact and be involved in their lives, in their ministries, to bring that back home.
This may be accentuating the obvious, but wouldn't one of the tenets be just because what you're talking about is forming a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of the emergent theology, the relationship that God has with us and therefore with one another. And so for us to be in mission, we've got to have a relationship with a set of missionaries.
It's got to be. It's got to be there. Otherwise, it's nothing. It's nothing without that. That's exactly right.
We'll do missions, but we won't be missional. It's one of the big problems.
Exactly. And one of the characteristics, incarnational, neo-monastic, and missional, and community-oriented. Missional is a big part of their self-definition. Gradually, what we're building here, of course, is the definition. Okay, now...
Why hasn't it occurred to emergence to forgive the otherness in the institution?
Good question. I'll ask Brian when next... I don't know. Maybe because the institution is a thing.
Well, we're competing, too. There's this tension that...
I think there is some competition. I think there absolutely is some competition, and that scares me more than anything else. The competition we probably don't need. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, plus the institution represents mom and dad, and it is the common enemy.
But not for the older emergent emergents, folk, you know, whose mom and dad are long since gone. And they too are. When I go into a traditional worship service, I have trouble with the staidness of it, with the fixedness of it. I've been around emergence Christianity long enough now, so I want some action. I've become sort of incarnational with it too. Mm-hmm. And the institution bothers me that it doesn't put any elasticity in it, any vitality. It seems to me to be very often sucked dry.
Can you define what you would say as you want some action? What is it that you experience?
Well, I want to feel something. I want to move. I probably want to dance at some point during the service. I like the fact somebody was painting this morning. I really sort of the dramatization of the wedding at Cana may not have been the most artful I ever saw, but it shakes things up a little bit. The music was wonderful. One of the things that you usually get when you do this exercise or whatever you call this is that somebody says the worth of the institution also is that it's patron of the arts. and it's the arts that the institution, that if you really think about it, the great art has all come from the Christian church. Emergence, of course, of trying to counter that by doing things like what we saw this morning, bringing the arts back in. But that's one of the reasons to keep the institution, is as a conservator of those. But in terms of the worship, I want some movement. I want some vitality. Probably because I'm Southern, I want to hear somebody say, "You go, sister," or "Tell it, Lord," a little of that participation. I really like being able to question a sermon, even though when I'm doing the sermon, it makes me a little unhappy. But I like the digesting by the group of the word afterwards. All of those things. And I'm allergic to programs. I'm that much of an emergence, too. Don't give me a program. I'll go to, well, we're back where you were. I'll go to a Bible study in the afternoon or something, but don't give me a program in Sunday school. Don't even talk to me about Sunday school. I don't want to do that. So that much of it is, yeah. All right. Enough said. Let us move on to something else. Now, what I want to say next is that almost every church in this country, and certainly in the UK it's true, is aware, first of all, of the problem, and then is attempting to solve it along, again, some kind of spectrum. That is to say, you have what's called the traditional service, usually at 11 o'clock, and it's straight by the book, and it's the institution's service. If you're aware that emergence is around you somewhere, or that there are emergent constituents in your congregation, or that there's a movement toward emergence, you may pick up a contemporary service. And a contemporary service is different from a traditional service in that it's got a drop-down screen and a good acoustical system. And that's about the difference. And it usually is, and it will have contemporary music, obviously. But it's an attempt to accommodate. It's not an emergence, and it sure isn't hyphenated at all. Then, if you're really brave, you'll go over here to something called alt worship. And alt worship really does mess with the liturgy a little bit. It lets some air in. It can still be in your physical. It's alternative, yeah. Alt worship. It's got some emergence to it, but it will stick by the liturgy tweaked a little bit, so to speak. It will open it up some, and it might even allow for liturgical dance to occur during it, and might even have some painting going on. What I saw this morning maybe was nearer to alt worship than it was to frankly hyphenated. Or you can go all the way over here and you can pick up a frankly emergent service. But you probably, as I said earlier, you cannot do it in your space. But that's the spectrum on which it can be done. Can you plant an emergent church? No. Can you enable one? Yes, you can. You can spot them and now. Having said that, there are churches who have shown themselves willing to let their assistant rector, or sometimes even their rector, have like a $250 line item in the budget that's not to be questioned, and that $250 is to be spent in pub after pub after pub until he or she find on Friday afternoon, go drink for an hour. How hard is that job? Until you find a group of people who begin to want to talk. And they come up out of pub theology, and they become absolute emergent communities. And they will grow and grow until they become a church. That will work. The UK, which is way ahead of us by at least 20 or 25 years, the present Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who has been deeply involved with the emergence movement from the get-go, who, when Brian McLaurin's The Generous Orthodoxy came out, said he was on a plane when he read that book, and he said, "I read that book and I wanted to land and go immediately over to the control tower and hire every single airplane that was free and buy every copy of that book that I could that was in print, and then have them broadcast all over, airlifted all over the UK, because this is what my people have to hear. This is where the church is going," he says. And so he began to do, it's exactly what he, and Brian McLaurin spoke at a Lambeth conference last year. He and Jonathan Sacks, the rabbi of the UK, and one other non-Anglicans were invited to speak, and Brian was one of them, simply because of what the Archbishop thinks is happening. And so he began to talk about mixed economy churches. And he says, a mixed economy church is one which could keep its traditional Anglican stance, or congregation, or parish, if you will, but also can pick up one of these others, can either pick up an alt worship and keep it in-house, or can manage to go rent some free commercial secular space and have an absolute emergence or an Anglo-emergence church. In the UK, for it to be an Anglo-emergent church, it has to be served by an ordained Anglican priest. That priest has only one obligation, to grow this thing up, and he must once a year, and he can do more if he wants to, but once a year he must sit with his sitting diocesan for 1 hour. They can have tea, they can talk about soccer, they can do whatever they want to, but for 1 hour a year, he has to check in. It comes under the Towney Report. He has to check in with his sitting diocesan. That keeps this thing over here connected to some extent. That's Antioch and Jerusalem. Now, presumably they don't talk about soccer, and presumably no real priest out here doing an emergence church really only wants to be with his bishop only once a year. Credibly speaking, it's a lot more than that. But legally, they are cut free enough to do that. The other way to go at it, and the Archbishop is very eager to have this happen, is for several churches within a near geographic area to get together and to realize that somewhere in the middle, there's probably a place that's not served, and to put their forces together and put some money together and see if you can open up a storefront church or a church in a yoga class or one of the ones that's been most productive for them. After school classes or at day schools like this one where mamas all come to pick up the kids at 3 o'clock, have a little service for the kids that starts at 2:30, and the kids do part of the performing, and sure enough, the mamas will come a little early in order to see the kids perform, and the first thing you know, you've got another church that's functioning in a different way. There are all kinds of ways to do it, but it can be done. And my words to you are that music is very often the key. And if there's anything you all have got, it's music. And you can become the best church planters in the world just with your music skills. It will happen.